Good evening, everyone. My name is Betty Pyatt, and I am an alcoholic. And it is only through the grace of God, a God that I found in this program, and people just like you who loved me enough and encouraged me to get involved in my own recovery. That's the only reason I'm here tonight. Filled with a love, with a peace, and with joy. And for that I say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is April the 23rd, 1985. Before I get started, I would like to say thank you so much to each and every member of the committee that put this wonderful conference together. I'm not real good with names, and I've met so many new and wonderful people. And so I just say to each and every one of you, I know how hard it is to put together something like this, and to do it from out of town, to me, would seem, what an order. I couldn't go through it. But it's been a wonderful experience for me, and I thank each and every one of you, the phone calls, the love, the concern, the hosting, to all of you on the committee, thank you so much. You know, every time I try, I owe this program, and I've tried the best of my ability to pay back, and you know, it's so hard because I just keep getting and getting and getting. And so again, I say thank you. I want to thank all the wonderful people that hosted us and took us to dinners and to lunches with all of their friends, and to each and every one of you who has hugged me through this whole weekend and is here tonight just sharing your love with me. Thank you. You know, when I go home and I'm going to want to come back to a really special place, I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to be able to see that mountain covered with chocolate chip cookies and melt in your mouth. I have never seen so many chocolate chip cookies in my life. Boy, thank you. I spoke with my sponsor yesterday and she reminded me that when I'm asked to share, I have nothing to share with you but my experience, strength, and hope. And anything else I try to say is going to be a lie. So with all the earnestness at my command, I will try to share with you as honestly as I can what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And for that, I'm going to take you all the way back. I was born December the 13th, 1930, and I'll let you do the math, to an unwed mother who was a student nurse. And at that, back in 1930, I was given away immediately for adoption. I stayed in the little girl's orphanage for a couple of years and was blessed to be taken up for and adopted by a family who lived in Las Vegas and had a daughter who was 4 years older than I was. And so I stayed in Las Vegas until I was, around 4 years old. Now, that was in the early 30s, and times were hard. And so my dad moved us all back to Santa Fe where he could get a job with the state. And I was immediately enrolled in Loretto Academy School for Girls. Now, I want you to know that right from the get-go, I did not fit the plan of a good little Catholic girl that sits with her skirt pulled down and her hands folded. Because I want to know why. And because when you tell me why, I've got a better reason. And don't tell me thou shalt not, because I can figure out a way that it'll be okay for both of us. So that was my experience in Catholic school. I have to tell you that my mom and dad never told me that I was adopted. But you know how kids are, and they have big ears, and people would visit with my mom and they'd say, oh, is that her? And oh, isn't she cute? And I knew there was something different going on. And when I was 11 years old, my mom had a little boy. And of course, he was the apple of my dad's eye. So now I'm the middle kid. I've got an older sister, and then there's me, and then there's my little brother. And people would say to my mom, you're so lucky. You have a daughter that looks just like you and a son that looks just like his dad. And I'd say, well, Mom, who do I look like? And she'd say, oh, Betty Marie, you just look like Betty Marie. Well, you know, there was unrest within me. And I know one time we were out on the playground playing a silly little game called Colors, where there was a stepmother and the big bad wolf and Colors. And there was no running. The stepmother couldn't do any running. And so nobody wanted to be the stepmother. And one of the little girls said, let Betty Marie be the stepmother. She has a stepmother. She'll know how to act. Well, my heart sunk. My secret was out. They knew. And I immediately went in, not just anger, but a tremendous rage. And that was pretty frightening because we were all pretty young kids. But I knew then that my secret was out, that everybody knew, and I was different. Well, we continued on. I went through school. When I was in junior high school, the war was on, World War II, and there was a tremendous shortage of nurses, and so I got a job as a nurse's aide at the local hospital. And at that time, they had the Cadet Nurse Corps. And right away, I idolized those women. And what it was, you would graduate from high school and sign up for the Cadet Nurse Corps. They would put you through nursing school, and then you would serve a certain number of years with the military. And so that was my life. It was planned. That's what I was going to do. But in 1948, when I graduated from high school, the war was over and the Cadet Nurse Corps was abolished. And so much for that plan. Well, I decided I'll show them. I'll just get a job, save some money, and put my own self through school. Now, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at that time, there wasn't a big demand for young ladies just out of high school with really no skills. And so I had an opportunity either to go to work for state government or the telephone company. And I didn't have any political mentor to get me into state government, so I went to work for the telephone company. And that was in the days when there was lights on the board and cords, and the operator said, number please. And it was a good experience for me. It taught me responsibility. I had my own spending money. I didn't learn much about how to handle that, but that's another program and another story. We all had to join the union. Now, you know, I'm 17, 18 years old. I'm going to do what everybody else says. So we joined the union. And once a month we had a meeting, and we would go to different people's houses and we would deal with our business. And then we would all pitch in money in the kitty, and they would order either a case of beer or a bottle of booze. In those days, they would deliver it to your house. And I don't remember getting drunk at those meetings, but I do remember that I stayed until I drank my share. And if anybody had to leave early, I was available to help finish it up. We used to get paid once a week, and one time we all us gals got together and decided we would go to a little town, Española, New Mexico, which was about 26 miles north of Santa Fe, and go dancing because they wouldn't cart us there. And so we all drive up there, and so we sit around this table, and everybody orders drinks. And one gal said, I think I'll have a zombie. Well, I didn't know what that was. It sounded like a plan to me. So I didn't have one zombie. I had two. And what happened was I got drunk, I blacked out, and I got very, very sick. And I can remember those gals driving round and round in town until I got sober enough to be able to crawl up the stairs home. And when I got up the next morning feeling really bad, you know what my first thought was? Gosh, that was fun. I wonder when we're going to do it again. Well, you know, I continued working. My sister was dating a young man. They were getting kind of serious. And he came over to visit my mom one time. And he brought her this bottle of sherry herring. And so my dad opened the bottle, and everybody got a little glass, you know, and they all drank it and sipped it and everything. And Mom put the bottle away, and she said, you know, it wasn't very good. Well, you know, nobody asked me. But the same group of gals, we would get together, and once a week we'd go roller skating. So I lived on the north end of town, and the only girl that had a car would come by and pick me up first. And I would invite her into the kitchen, and we'd pour out a little glass of this sherry herring, and then we'd go skating away. Well, you know, one Saturday morning we're cleaning house, and Mom looks at the bottle, and it's empty, and she said, well, what do you suppose happened to this? And I said, oh, Mom, it was all sugar. It evaporated. So, you know, I was already beginning my journey. My sister got married, and my brother-in-law had his younger brother be the best man. So we were invited to a lot of parties, and he and I got along pretty good. And after my sister was married, he and I were dating, and my sister was married in June. And the following February, I was pregnant and married. We do that a lot in my family. The one thing my husband said to me was, no wife of mine is going to work. So I was a stay-at-home mom. And God blessed us with five children. One of the traditions we had in my house, I didn't drink when I was pregnant, not because I didn't try, but I just physically couldn't. And when I had my first child, the doctor said to me, are you planning to nurse the baby? And I said, yes. And he said, well, I suggest that you drink a little beer. That helps the process. And so it was a tradition. Every time there was a new baby in the family, Daddy would go pick up Mom from the hospital and the new baby, stop at the liquor store for a case of beer. And I mean, you know, I was raising my family. I can also tell you that my husband wasn't Catholic, but I still was. And so we were raising our kids in the church, and that means, you know, there's godparents because you've got baptism, confirmation, and then First Communion and, you know, graduations and on and on. And so the one thing that I can tell you as I look back over now that I'm sober is, if you didn't drink, you really weren't invited to be part of this godfatherhood, you know. And we would have these big parties. And we lived, I'm sure some of you have heard in Santa Fe, they have the Burning of Old Man Gloom at the annual fiesta. And we lived only a couple of blocks away from the big park where that all took place. And people would come to our house and park their car, and we would have a party. So for about a week before the party, our friends would start bringing in the supplies, you know. There was always cases of beer and booze, and we'd order a keg. And, you know, after I got sober, one of my kids said to me, Mom, do you remember those fiesta parties? It was a bigger celebration than Christmas was. Wow. And so it went. You know, my husband was self-employed, and every Friday he had to put out a report. And in those days, he had a mimeograph machine, a hand-crank mimeograph machine, and then he'd fold up these papers, and we'd lick the envelopes and put the stamps on it. So Friday at noon, he would quit work, come home, and run off his report, and we'd buy a case of beer because we had to lick the envelopes. And so the weekend would start Friday afternoon and Saturday and Sunday, you know. And as the years progressed, sometimes the weekend would start on Thursday to get ready for Friday. And sometimes by Sunday, it was better to have a little bit more on Monday. My husband and I were drinking buddies. So the kids grew up, and we found ourselves with three children in college. And although they were all working and had scholarships, finances were a little tight. And so my husband said, yes, you can go back to work. So I went back to the telephone company to work, and I was working late hours. And after a couple of years, I bridged my previous service, and so I had some pretty choice hours. I could go to work at, say, 5 in the evening and work till 11 or 6 till midnight. And that worked really nice because I could be home during the day and then work in the evening. The only thing is, like on the weekends, it was hard to drink all day and then shower and sober up and go to work. And one Saturday night, I guess I went to work a little boisterous. And the chief operator called me off the board, and she said, Betty, I'm only going to ask you this once. And I knew what was coming. But you see, I had been to parties, and I had had drinks with this lady, and I knew she was worse than me. I mean, I saw her some mornings shaking, you know. She said, did you come to work drunk? And I said, no. And she said, all right. Well, you know what that meant? It meant I had to eat more mints and not be so noisy. So life continued on, and technology improved, The chord boards went away. The dial tone came in. There was a lot of progress in technology, and pretty soon different offices began to shut down, and offices began to consolidate. And by then I had worked myself up through as supervisor, and then I was an evening chief operator. And the only choice I had left at that point, they were going to close the office, was either to commute to Albuquerque or try to get into the business sales department. And so, you know how we are. You give me a challenge and you give me a test and I'm going to be ready and I'm going to do it. And I did. And I tested out and I was accepted as part of the sales team. Now, they were very kind. They sent me to Phoenix for a month to be trained on the type of equipment I was going to be selling. And the training center was, they had a motel that was within walking distance of the training center. And every day we would go and we would get three tickets. One ticket was for breakfast and two tickets were for cocktails. Well, you know, it didn't take me long to figure out who didn't drink. And I had a lot of tickets. And so I would go to class all day. And then in the evening I would study in the bar and eat popcorn. I mean, that, you know, worked really well. You know, it was a job I really enjoyed. Jokingly, they used to say to me, "You are the EEOC." I was Hispanic, I was over 55, and I was female. And so I was out selling telephone equipment and really enjoying it. As a matter of fact, I was doing a little bit better than most of the men in the office, and I think it kind of bothered them. And so we would have these meetings, and they would set this benchmark, you know. And then, you know, I'm competitive. You tell me I've got to do this, I'm going to do this. You know, and so I continued on and work and work. And while all that was going on, my husband was still self-employed. He developed heart trouble and at one point had to have bypass surgery. And so we took him to Albuquerque and he had that done and had a quadruple bypass. And after about 9 days in the hospital, I brought him home. Some of the things that I've done in my drinking days I'm not really proud of, but I want to share this with you because I want you to know where my life was headed. I went to Albuquerque and picked him up, and most of you that are familiar with open heart surgery know that you have to crack the ribs and make an incision, and it's pretty ugly, and it was just healing, and he was sitting in the back seat of the car with his shirt open, still healing from this wound, and I had a nice chest of beer, and I popped one open and I said, "You haven't had a drink for a whole week. You're a good boy." And so we started drinking on the way home. Now, when we got home, he really tried to develop a better, healthier lifestyle. He was walking every day. And he said our drinking was just going to be Saturdays and Sunday afternoon after the football game was over. We wouldn't drink anymore. And I thought, who made that rule? You know? Well, that was when I learned that I could pour bourbon on cake and Kahlua in coffee, and I had my ways. We only had one child left at home. All the rest are away at college or working, and I can remember coming home from work and my husband saying to my youngest son, "If you want dinner, you better get it before your mother gets drunk." And I thought, Well, I knew why it was, because I would come home, and we had this little cabinet, and it made a noise when you pulled it open, and I'd pour out, some scotch, and then I'd go to the refrigerator and get some ice. That makes noise, and, you know. So I solved that problem. Every morning before I went to work, I opened up the liquor cabinet, and I learned to drink drinks without ice. You know, there is a solution. Well, So we're continuing on. Technology is getting better, you know, and then comes the big split and the Bell system and, you know, all of that. And they started offering early retirement to people. And all of my friends and my family got wind of this. "Well, Betty, you'll get to retire early and you can go and stay home and take care of your husband." Well, I had a job that I really liked, and I had an account, you know, a business account. I had these power lunches. And, you know, one of the accounts was the college. And I tell you, the brothers make the best wine. And, but I didn't want to. One of the things was they told me I could retire early. And then when I was 65, I would get a little pension. And in my heart, I knew am I going to live to be 65? You know, I want to just stay here and do this and keep on doing this. But there was a lot of pressure. My family and my friends were all expecting me to do it. And so reluctantly, I took the early retirement package. And I'll tell you right now, that was God working in my life. I never went to work to work drunk, but I did drive the company car with bad hangovers. And, you know, I was working toward a situation where I could have made a bad mistake with one of these poor customers or hurt somebody in a company vehicle, and it would have been tragic. And so God took care of the Bell Company, and I retired. So my husband and I had a son that was teaching in Topeka, Kansas, and we decided we'd take a little vacation and we'd take a couple of the grandkids and fly there. And we did do that. And we flew to Topeka, and that night we all, we had done a little sightseeing. We were sitting down having a drink, what else, and trying to plan what we were going to do the next day. And my husband suffered a heart attack. And we left on vacation that weekend, and we came home 8 days later, and I buried him. And, you know, I said to my children, I'm fine. You know, and I said to God, I know you were going to get even with me sometime, but did you have to do this? You know, now never mind that my children had lost their father, that his brothers and sisters had lost a brother they really cared for, that my mom had lost a son-in-law that she really loved. I had lost my drinking partner, and I was fine. And every night, I would close the curtains and sail away with Cuddy. By then, scotch was my drink of choice. Somebody told me that if you drink scotch, you don't get a hangover. Don't believe them. Also, I was developing some sort of gastric problems, and the only way I could drink was to mix it in milk. Now, when I sit in meetings and we read that story about the man and the milk punch, and everybody says, they don't know what they were missing. So, like I said, I found myself. Now I'm home alone. I had quit my job, and I decided, I think I'll go back to college. I'm going to go to college, and I'm going to get a new career. And computers were the big thing then, you know, so I'm going to become a computer programmer. My sponsor tells me it was a little grandiose, but, you know, so I'm enrolled in computer programming and computer science and algebra. Now, if any of you know me very well, you know that to balance my checkbook, I break out in hives. And I'm taking all these classes, and then I'm taking swimming because I'm going to be a well-rounded person.
I was going to get it.
Of people, cars, beat this, beat that, did this, did that. And this little guy comes running across the room. A bottle of beer, they don't want to hear your shit. He says, so look at this, look at this. He says, you see this? No, I'll do it. And I believe it says somewhere right in here that if not, Vela Crucial and Vital Step. It's about 6:15 in the morning. He says the birds are singing. I believe that God will and can restore you to sanity. But what did the book look at the problem from an entirely different angle? We look at it, where was I selfish? You're egotistical, you're selfish, you're self-centered, you want everything your way, but you nothing. And God of the Spirit. And I was rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. Now, but what happened for me was, is that I'm trying to fix myself. You see, you can't cure an alcoholic mind with an alcoholic mind. And that's what I was trying to end, Joe, isn't about going back to people and telling them how sorry you are. They know that already. Making a point. He says, you earned $83.68 on 9 different jobs. I calculated how much I spent on drinking and Ujo. He heard me.
See, they don't exclude anybody. They don't exclude this sunglass boutique. I guess they want to buy drunk a lot. But I love them. I was a bar drinker. I really was. I'd hang out at the bar with Stuart, and I'd drink water for a long time. Never drank. But I love the bar. I'll celebrate the wife, you know, in the hospital. Well, you know, they were out there dancing together. Out there, and then they left together, you know, and there I was. And drunk drivers ever get picked up. And I thought, phew, I can drink. Do you have another cocktail? I'm okay. When I drink every time, then I feel comfortable. I just kind of intuitively used to know how to handle situations that would baffle me. You know? In the mountains. It really is. It's right up there in the mountains. Scientific fact. People who live at high altitudes for prolonged periods of time, working on thickening up my blood. And when you're in that kind of license, I didn't have a driver's license. You know, they'd taken that 3 DWIs earlier, you know, so I didn't have one. I wanted $18,000. I couldn't believe it. I was so frustrated. I said, honey, we have a bed for you tonight. Now they're high pressuring me to get me to come in down there. I'm the consumer close to a $9 a day jitter joint. Okay? I'm watching them go in and out of there all day long. And you know what? They were alcoholics. These two guys from outside talked for a long time, and then they... And I didn't hear a damn thing they said, because I'm watching whatever. The way he thought, I acted the way he acted. I was totally scared to death. Because now what do I do? I know I'm an alcoholic. So your aftercare is you go to AA. That'll be your aftercare program. You go to AA. So I drove back to Illinois so that we can meet. So I'm not going. I said, well, then, you know, call them and let them know that I'm coming. He said, they'll be there. He's not even anonymous anymore. I mean, Jesus. I could look him up in the phone book if I want. Son of a bitch is jealous. I mean, I drink when I feel better, right? I don't want to feel honest. So I'm walking around Reno feeling better, going nuts. And there at the men's tag meeting, it was Christmas Eve. So that Thursday fell on Christmas Eve, and they announced at the men's tag. I heard in that month I'd been going, I'm probably the only guy in this meeting tonight without a big book. I'm going to win the book. So I'm praying for my book. By the time that, right? Well, I'm glad Don didn't believe that nonsense. I'm glad Don understood. New Year's Eve, you know? They may fish out there one more night, you know? Call tomorrow. Because he's just driving to the meetup. So I start telling Glenn all about Alcoholics Anonymous. I say, Glenn, you wouldn't believe this, man. When you go to be women at your first meeting, you know? You're going to love this, you know? There's going to be women there. You're going to want to come back every Friday night to do this, Glenn, and you're going to love it. And then when you get there, it taught me how God works. Because God works through people. God works through people. See? By working for, and those that are out there drinking and dying. We both had that moment. I think what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is really pretty simple. My moment. Yeah. Screw that. I did it worse. You know? We keep it alive and no issues that I need to cover with you. Man, I'm listening to that. I was so screwed up and messed after about 6 months. I went to my sponsor and I said, okay? And after you've been so kind to invite me up and treat us so well up here, I don't want anybody to leave and not know that simple thing. And the main purpose of the book is to enable you to find a power, as the third step says. There's a lot of people in the world, you know? That ain't going to happen. Let's get real. I need to do something myself. I need to take control of my life. That birthday party. Big, big party. 200 people there. After the birthday party, I'm getting ready to leave to go home. And Joanne's working the front desk. Joanne's for an AA group. We got, what do we got there? Out of 150 groups in the Metroplex. There are people in Dallas North that night. And Joanne picks me to give the 12-step call to. And I know where Dome Street is. You know the odds of that? I'm a... That'll work. That'll work all the time. It's like a few years after I'm getting ready to go on an airplane out to California, right? I'm needle pointing. And she's embarrassed. You know, she's old enough to know she's needle pointing. I said, you are too. What is that you're needle pointing? So she holds. She says, well, they call it the serenity prayer. She's nervous. She says, but I'm trying to lead a spiritual life. I said, really? She says, yeah, she's needle pointing. So I said, honey, wait, you know? And any time where I wasn't running to do something, and... So I'm sitting there in Salt Lake City Airport, and I started into that function in your life. And it's an incredible thing that we got here. And it'll happen when one...
of alcohol or any pocket rocket or any mood-changing woman, ma'am, will do if you want it. And neither am I good at. I've heard a lot of them. Well, what it's like, that's all right. I never saw it. As a special assistant to the United States Attorney General in the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice. I had the fuzz. I thought I'd been arrested. I had quite a difference being dry and being sober in my book. That's just my opinion. Sometimes. Herbert Spencer once said that there was a certain principle which was a bar to all information and proof against any argument that may, as far as I was concerned, I... And I want you to call reading what Voltaire once said, I may not agree with the word that you say, but I'll... After I was in a while, and I started to be a sponsor, and I'd get all hepped up, you know. Now, everybody isn't ready for this deal. Let's not kid ourselves. You betcha. As long as you keep coming back, you get a chance. It reminds me of the guy down here in Dallas, a salesman. This is not being ready. And he had a racket going that he'd read that Dallas Morning New place. And he started his pitch, and she said, I'm not ready. And he kept talking, and that poor woman like she had a conniption fit. And with that, he sighed because I wanted to go home. So like a jail was. But we didn't go that way. We got in an elevator, and I asked him, I said, where are we going, Johnny? And he, where are we going, Art? And I didn't want to stay sober either. And so help me, I've never drank so much coffee before, a shot of... Got to be honest, John, this thing. Jesus, tell me. I'm beginning to see things in the clouds and hairs coming out the ends of my fingers. But the length of time that it takes to change the direction of a man or a woman's life is the same length of time that it takes often. And I go for it. That we in AA love drinking. Yes, drinking. Somebody say, oh, yes, I worked these 12 steps. Yes, you did like hell working 12 steps. One of the boys on the well, they call them circuit riders, but I do travel a lot, and I was in to watch your hands in action. But your Canadian brothers and sisters, these are the words of Bill Wilson. He said, Al-Anon is the wife, Polly. We were divorced in 1951. Oh, yes, I promised Saturday, bingo. And I had to set up the tables and get everything ready. I told Karen, I said, Karen, I'm positive I saw those beads that last... Oh, boy, might get home. Yeah. It's only been 15 years. And come home. And, of course, when she said this, I couldn't get it out quickly enough. You bet, honey. My partner said, let's go in town this afternoon. This thing might come in, boy. And we tried to do something out there at Window Rock in AA. He didn't know where his grandfather got him. And I'm in Hawaii 3 years ago. Teachers, I had tried librarians, I had tried South Dakota. And he said, now he had not contacted, had any time to contact Stone. Let me always walk with beauty and my eyes. And Bill, and that little fellow who went to Bill on that November afternoon, none of us, in my opinion, would be here today if it hadn't been for Abby Thatcher. Thank you.
About shy of 14 years, and in that time is today, it seems. It convinced me that I was born worthless. I came here with two strikes against me, And the only way that I could survive was to admit that I was not worth anything and move towards some sort of record. I'd be worthy. Well, I took that very seriously. I really felt as though I was not very worthwhile. I'm sure if Sigmund Freud were around and I were on his couch long enough, I would be able to tell you that it was because my father left, yada, yada, yada. My mother was too protective, yada, yada, yada. Well, it doesn't matter why. You know, that's the one thing I have learned. It doesn't at all matter why. Because the solution is the same, regardless of the conditions. I first got loaded when I was seriously loaded when I was 18 years old. I was in a rock and roll band, and we were in a place called Biloxi, Mississippi, and it was in the height of the Vietnam War, and we picked up some sailors who were getting shipped off to Nam in a few days, and so we got a bunch of booze. I think we actually robbed the liquor store to get it. Not really robbed. That sounds too dramatic. It's not like Woody Harrelson and Natural Born Killers or anything. There was some old lady who was head of the, and she couldn't see anything anyway. So, and when she turned her head, I just grabbed whatever bottles I could. I didn't know anything about booze, although it was always around my house, and being from New Orleans, Louisiana, it's the only time in the world where the signs on the bar say happy hour any waking moment. We grabbed what we could and went to the back of this club where my band was playing, and we had a very, very esoteric collection, eclectic collection of alcohol, everything from schnapps to Southern Comfort. I had a tendency to go for the thicker ones for some reason. They were more like dessert to me. So everybody sort of sampled. There were like eight of us in this band, and these two sailors. And everybody sort of sampled from the bottles and found something they liked and had a few more swigs of it. I continued to drink. I continued to savor the different aromas and textures and palate of the different booze. Until about a half hour later, I just did this huge technicolor yawn all over the sea. I don't know if you guys know what a pousse café is, but it's a drink that has different colored layers of liqueur. Well, that's what my car seat looked like. So from the moment I started drinking, I drank alcoholically. There was never enough. Somewhere in my personality, I have the psychology that if something is good, then more of it must be better. It seems very logical and very simple equation. I could never understand why someone would go out and have a drink or two drinks. Like my wife can. My wife considers alcohol a beverage. I don't understand that philosophy. To me, it's medicine. And the more medicine you take, the better, right? Whether it's booze or later in the 80s when I couldn't afford that NyQuil. Long before I started drinking, and I know that's now only in retrospect, I was born an alcoholic. I had the personality defects that every good alcoholic should have, or extreme lack of self-esteem, coupled with this grandiose self-image. The two did not cohabitate well. And they produced phenomenally erratic behavior. I was very afraid of you because it was logical that if I didn't know who I was and didn't like me very much, how could you possibly? So in the 60s, luckily the Beatles came along and I was able to adopt personalities that were more in vogue at the time. I was nuts before I ever drank. There are people in this world to this day that that have relationships with me for months on end, and I'm a totally different person, different name, from a different country. I don't doubt that there's some 50-year-old woman out there sitting at home looking at television and thinking, Jesus Christ, he looks like that English guy I met in the 60s. But it was so wonderful to be able to concoct a life that I figured was successful. It was so easy to pretend I was somebody else so that I could put in place the personality traits and the emotions that I thought was made up a whole healthy human being. And I was very good at it. And then in the early 70s, I heard there was actually a place where you could go where they paid you to do that. There was nothing else I could be but an actor. You know, I lied too well not to be. I don't lie as much anymore, by the way, except when I get paid these days. So Catholicism and fear and all of that stuff drove me most of my life. I mean, I was such a coward. I had such fear that at any moment either God or the authoritarian figure of whoever happened to be in front of me was going to eradicate my existence under this constant low-grade fear. Clancy talks about that, where you wake up every morning and you just know that the day is probably not going to wind up being very nice, that something's going to happen to you to verify the opinion you have of yourself. I can only say that I am very glad that I found alcohol when I did, because I do believe that alcohol prevented me from going completely psychotic. I do believe that when you're unconscious, it's hard to be nuts. I'm sure I've been talking to my dog, and he would have been telling me who to go kill if I had not had something that would turn it off, you know, that would turn me off. And fortunately, I was a child of the 60s. Consequently, I had the opportunity to blaze trails into chemicals that I felt like, Captain Kirk. I was going where no man had gone before. And I was blazing, and I was in absolutely off the edge from the moment. Now, you know, I didn't get arrested very much. I didn't rob people, except if you had better dope than I. I didn't. But I certainly stole people's lives in a way. You know, I was once described by a girlfriend as a psychic vampire. And I would sort of just suck out of you everything worthwhile and then leave you hollow and starving on the ground. And so, as I found another host. It's terrible, but it's true. You know, I'll tell you how insane I was. Not that you don't probably already know that. When I was in fourth grade, I was 10 years old, I lost a book, a catechism book. And the nun, whose name escapes me, but in my mind she has become Sister Mary Rhino for some reason. I knew that I could not go back to her class without this book, otherwise my ass would be grass. So I thought, what can I do? Well, logically, I thought, well, I'll run away. And so I looked at some friends. I was on the playground with them, and I said, I'm going over to the convent for a music lesson. And I walked off the schoolyard, and I walked past the convent, and I kept walking. And I was 10 years old. In the heart of New Orleans, very close to the Mississippi River. The levee runs right back of the school. So I got on top of the levee, and I started walking downriver toward No Man's Land, Chalmette, St. Bernard, weird places where you go get oysters and fireworks, and that's the only reason to be there. And I was going all day. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I hadn't eaten, I was scared, and I thought, well, I guess what do I have to do now? Well, I can't go back and tell the truth. Which never even occurred to me as an option. I mean, it wasn't even like I had that thought. It wasn't truth or, it was which lie. And actually, being unwilling to take any responsibility whatsoever for my actions, I devised a plan. So I tore my clothes a bit, my little Catholic uniform, and I scraped my knuckles on the sidewalk, and I started going back toward the school. And about 2 blocks from the school, I assumed this sort of Quasimodo pose. Sort of limped back to the school. And the nuns come, you know, floating out of the building toward me. And I've written 9 inventories in the Catholic Church, and I've got such a long way to go yet. Anyway, they swooped me up and brought me into the school and said, what happened? And being faced with this dilemma, I fessed up that I had been kidnapped. That a man had found me outside the convent just before I'd gotten in, threw me in the back of his truck, and took me away, and kept me all day. And I didn't know anything about sex at the time, so it didn't even occur to me that, you know, he had touched me in that special place or anything. I didn't even go that far with the story. And what little imagination I had at the time when they asked what he made me do, he said, all I could think of was he made me listen to the radio. So my mother was called, and my grandfather, who we lived with, and my old man left, we moved in with my grandmother and grandfather, ostensibly raised by my grandmother. My mother worked. So anyway, she comes screaming and crying and delirious. Everybody's been looking for me, and so they take me home, and she gives me ice cream and puts me in bed, and I think, well, at 6 o'clock, there was a knock on the door, and there were two men standing at the door, and it was the police. And so the police came in, and they sat me down and said, so we hear something really terrible happened to you today. Would you tell us about it? Well, it was a little too early to drop the story, it seemed to me, so I proceeded to enlighten them on my predicament that day. Embroidered it somewhat, and gave a description of a guy who really sort of looked like there wasn't Wells, because I think the third man had come out about that time, so that's the image I had in my mind of Harry Lime. They nodded, and they gave a lot of sympathy. They went away, and I thought, well, that's all right. 2 days later, they came back and said they had caught him. And to show you how a good alcoholic is, I really thought for a moment, wait a minute, did I get kidnapped? So now I've got a real dilemma here. Do I fess up to losing a 75-cent book, or do I send this bastard to jail for 30 years? I think the scales were almost even, I think, for a little while. But I didn't. I finally, in a heap of tears and gnashing of teeth, I confessed what had happened. And everybody knew. You know, that's another thing that's great about us. We think we have this phenomenal facade going on, that we are streaming through the universe and nobody can touch us. And everybody knew from the get-go what had happened. These guys weren't cops. They were from school. They were very elaborate. I think they were drunks, too, because they went pretty far with the story. But that sort of incident is how I live my life. Faced with the possibility of admitting to you that I was a liar and a thief and a hollow individual, I would far rather concoct the most absurd reality to try and get any responsibility deflected away from me for my own actions. And it went on and on like that. And I did that to school. I did that to the United States Navy. You know, I mean, I did that to the United States government, for God's sake. And we won't get into that. That's a whole different thing. And I'm not sure if the statute of limitations have expired on that. So through the 60s, I drank a lot and did a lot of drugs. Moved to Colorado for a spiritual reason. The guy that used to make my LSD lived there. And I prided myself on taking the purest stuff, you understand. I mean, it had to be LSD 25 or nothing for me. I convinced myself once toward the end of my drinking that I didn't have a drinking problem because I only had like $5 on me. I went into a liquor store, and in front of me were these, you know, vats of Gallo Mountain Thorn wine or a half pint of Courvoisier cognac. Well, I chose the Courvoisier. So I figured if you go for quality and not quantity, you really can't have a problem. I moved to California in 1973 to pursue an acting career and was successful rather quickly as far as that goes, considering the amount of unemployment in my business. I received roles in television, etc. I married a woman in 1974, and things started going along well as far as my career was concerned. My first son was born in 1977. At that time, I had a regular job on my first series called Baba Black Sheep, and we were supposed to be braggarts and bon vivants and misfits. And so we lived the parts off screen as well as on screen. And things started going downhill then. Things started changing. Things changed because, for the first time that I really can recall, getting loaded became more important than anything else. That my life had to be designed around the possibility of where are we going to get screwed up tonight and with what. When my son was 10 months old, I sent my wife and he and my adopted daughter to England. My wife is English. I sent them to England because I thought it would be better if we lived alone separately. Financially, it would be easier. I just wanted to be able to drink without guilt. And I moved on to a friend's sailboat And basically, I laid down for 3 months. I was too big to stand in the boat. So this is how I discovered heroin. I described heroin as like being dead but still able to dance. I wasn't working. I was living off of residuals and unemployment, etc. I took a ride down to the blood bank for the first time in downtown Los Angeles. Some very large black fellow grabbed me and brought me in because if you could get an extra $2 if you're on the buddy system, if you brought a friend, they gave you an extra $2. And I'm lying on this table having the precious bodily fluids, drained out of me for $12. And I look over at the television. There's a little black and white television next to the bed, and I see myself on the television. And I thought, this is really wacky. And I remember saying at the time to myself, if you don't die, this is going to be a really great story on the Johnny Carson show one day. And it was, actually. So I got a job, and I got enough money to bring my family back from England and stuffed them into a small little apartment in North Hollywood somewhere. It was just horrible. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And, I wasn't abusive. I didn't beat my children or any of that stuff. I disappeared. I was the kind of drunk that would just want to be left alone, and so I would go away. I would get on a plane and leave. I would get into a bus and leave. Any place that was away from anybody I knew where I could, with some impunity, not be noticed as to what a slob I had become. I was 240 pounds at the time, and I looked like my face was just like stuffed with doorknobs. In 1980, I got a job in a film called Stripes, and we went to Kentucky to do this film. John Candy and I shared a motorhome, and during the time we were there, John Lennon was killed. And we had an Irish wake for about a month. I can watch that film today and literally not remember doing some of the scenes. And this was toward the end. It just got so bad. And I really kind of, in some ways, appreciate the fact that Mr. Lennon was shot, because it put me so far over the edge that I went to a place I had never gone before. I went to a place of being alone in a room, and I'm not going to get graphic, but it was pretty base. Pretty base what I was doing to myself in order to try and feel something other than this cold, vomit-smelling life I had created for myself. In May of 1981, I checked myself into a hospital just to escape, just to hide. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. It was never mentioned when I was a kid growing up. Dylan Thomas was once asked when he was a boy, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, I want to be the drunkest man in the world. And that was my goal. I thought all of my defects were pluses for my artistry. I thought that I alone in the world had the pioneer spirit of being out there on the edge to show you dull bastards what life could really be like. If you're afraid to walk through the fire, well, goddamn it, I'm not. Come on, let's go. When I walked into this hospital, on the bed stand next to me was this this book, this blue book thing that you guys, I guess, are familiar with. And I stayed up that night and read that book. And I put the book down and I thought, oh my God, that's the problem. I'm an alcoholic. So I left the hospital. I realize now that I know what the problem is, I can drink in peace. There won't be that nagging, why are you doing this? You're an alcoholic. Thank you. That went on for about 7 months, and in February of 1982, I got sober. For the first time and really only time, I didn't go in and out a lot. I couldn't imagine going back out there. I wasn't happy about being here, but I didn't want to go back out there again. In those days, it was mandatory that you smoke in a meeting. And so I'd be sitting in these rooms in basements of churches in Glendale and places I'd only read about in John Fante novels and Raymond Chandler novels that I didn't even know existed, and all of these old men with these long coats where you couldn't tell the difference between their ankles and their feet. They were so swollen. And I thought, gee, what has happened to me? What? This is it? Luckily, I was in one of those church basements, and A man stood up, an actor whose work I've admired all my life, and told his story. It was he was sober about 6 years then. And I'm sure as many of us have had this experience, my life fell out of this man's mouth. My spine sharpened. It was the most amazing experience I've ever had. And I realized, you know what, I'm no different than anybody in this room. I'm exactly the same as every single person in this room. Whether you were a woman or a man, or you weighed 300 pounds, or you were 90 years old, we all had something so intrinsically in common. The thing that I looked for all my life was the rest of the lepers. Where are the other lepers? The extreme individual I am, I got so active so fast that it's amazing I didn't get loaded. As I said, being Catholic, I have very heavy atheistic tendencies. And the only thing I thought that would stop me from staying here was this word on every wall I walked into, you know, in every room I walked into, this three-letter word. And I thought, you know, I don't know how I can stay here if I have to accept the fact that only this God thing can keep me sober. And I thought, you know, that doesn't seem fair. Luckily, the second step really saved my life, because in it doesn't say God. You know, it just says a higher power, you know, a power greater than myself. And I, at that point, even as what the enormously bloated ego I had, I could accept the fact that in the universe, somewhere, there must be a power greater than myself. And I don't mean that facetiously, you know. I mean, I read a lot of Ayn Rand growing up. I could walk out to the beach, though, and I could stand on the beach, and I could tell those waves to stop all day long, and they won't. They'll just keep doing their thing. The planet is a stronger power, you know, a higher power than myself. And I found a sponsor very quickly, and I chose an atheist, a Jewish atheist, which is... as far removed from my upbringing as I possibly can get. I didn't meet a Jew until I was 19 years old. I didn't know what it was. Being very Catholic, that was the only thing that existed in the South, and there was not very much else, except Democrat. And so I chose this Jewish atheist, and I said, you know, I don't know if I can stay here if I have to believe in God. And he said, fine, go get drunk. I said, well, there's got to be a compromise here somewhere. And so on a piece of paper, he wrote these words: God as I understand God is. And he put an ellipsis behind it, three dots. And he said, go home and finish the sentence. And so I went back to my little apartment, and Alan Watts novel Alan Watts book I had ever read, Baba Ram Das, Krishnamurti, I mean, all of those guys that I really craved as a young man to try to find the answer to myself, find that part of me that was connected to somehow, some divinity, somewhere. I know I had to be connected. So I finally finished the sentence one day, and I brought it back to him, and it was folded, and I handed it to him. I said, here, I finished the sentence. And he took it, and he tore it up. He said, fine, I'll pray for it. He didn't care what it was. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as you know it's not you. You know, that's the only thing I've known. You know, I got really, as I said, very active. I was a zealot. I mean, I was an obnoxious bastard about it. You know, I mean, I would walk into bars with a big book and find some likely candidate, you know, sitting at the bar like I would. I put the book down there. Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. Luckily, a lot of the behavior waned in me as I became willing to realize that unless you ask for it, I'm not going to give you the message. It doesn't do us any good to do that. And also that I only had to carry the message and not the drunk. I mean, I literally took guys from the parking lot and brought them to my house, and my wife would go, what are you doing with another one of these scabby old men in our house? And I would shower them. My son at that point was 5 or 6 years old. And I would take him with me to Barnstable Park, is where I found most of my likely candidates, in Vermont and Hollywood, where there's a huge Frank Lloyd Wright house at the top of the hill. And all these bums, there's this whole city that lives on the perimeter of this hillside overlooking Vermont. And I would go down there and find a candidate and take him to a meeting. And none of them stayed sober. Most of them died. But that didn't matter. Some of them stayed sober for a little while. I had guys that would actually drink their mother's perfume and stuff when they couldn't find any booze. And I thought, you know, I never thought of that. I used to have a lot of perfume. And, the idea of humility is a real strong notion with me these days. And I'm still a very grandiose, pompous asshole most of the time. But at least now I recognize that for myself. Before I thought it was an advantage, and now I know it's just me. But I realized that in order to achieve some sort of real, permanent spiritual awareness, I had to be willing to admit that someone else could teach me something about my own life. You know, and growing up Catholic, there was always people telling you about your life, you know. And actually there are some priests to this day who actually opened me up to a lot of the world, literature and art and music. But to be in one of these rooms and to look at some guy who has nothing, that's my definition of humility, you know. That I'm willing to look at your life and take from it some particle of sanity that I might be able to apply to mine. It's a remarkable experience. It's proven to me that we're all very much alike. And I don't say that with any sort of I get tongue-tied when I really try to think about the importance of sobriety in my life. You know, I would be dead. I mean, you know, we've heard it a lot from this podium, but there's absolutely no doubt about it. I'd be playing handball with John Belushi right now. You know, it's just. I've had a lot of people die on me in the 14 years that I have been sober. I recognize that most people in most meetings will die drunk. There's just no doubt about that. You know, just the statistics show that this is a killer and that many of us will die from it, regardless of how long we stay sober. And I've known men have gone out after 20 years, after 25 years, and never got back. You know, just one day, boom, glass of vino just happened to be in front of them. And the guys that do make it back, I make sure to go right up to them and look them right in the eye and ask them one question. What did you stop doing? What the hell where did you get this in your mind? You know? And almost invariably, it occurs that they stopped going to meetings. That they started isolating in meetings. That they started standing in the back of the room going,
there's a big bastard up there. I'm glad I'm not that bad.
God! Damn, why don't you go get a drink, buddy?
This separation again, you know? I lived most of my life separate from the rest of you. And once I was connected, and I got connected in these rooms, and I got connected in hospitals and lockups around this country, in the world, you know, I go to meetings in many countries of the world. I'm fortunate to have a job that actually allows me to travel, to sit in Newcastle upon Tyne, England, you know, or Paris, France, or Auckland, New Zealand, and know that somewhere in that town there are lepers. That I can walk with a bunch of other people who don't have noses and parts of their faces are falling off, you know, and I'll be right at home. It is a spectacular thing, and it is a simple thing. You know, I used to think that the answer had to be incredibly complicated to be worthwhile. I mean, anything that is simple, how could it possibly be worth my investment in it? You know, there's a bookstore in Los Angeles called the Bodhi Tree, a spiritual bookstore. It was born in the 60s, I guess, when we were all looking for answers of some sort or another, and most of us found them wrapped up and rolled up in little papers. And I would stand in this bookstore at 10:30 at night, and before I got sober, and pray that one of these books would just sort of fly off the shelf and hit me in the head. And it would fall open, and there would be the answer. How can I be comfortable being me without the necessity of lying to you or to myself? And I got to tell you, this book is the answer for me. And I think it's the answer for any alcoholic. I'd love to have it spread across the world for people who are not alcoholic. Because there's Henry Miller, great writer, once went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the late 40s. Didn't know what it was, wasn't a drunk himself. Went with a friend. And afterwards he wrote an essay. The essay was called The Hour of Man. And in it he described this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting he went to. And he was bewildered by the fact that, as we have done tonight, can laugh at the most horrendous disasters in one life. in one's life, that we can actually get some sort of fulfillment out of the fact that we lived hollow, desperate, sickening lives. Left people, you know, hordes bleeding and wounded behind us. And so he wrote in this essay that if the world ran like an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, we could disband every police force and every army on the planet. And here was a group of people who supposedly had nothing in common other than the fact that they suffered from this malady called alcoholism. And in the time that they are in this room together, what they care about most is staying sober and helping the person next to them stay sober for that evening. I mean, that cuts through all the bullshit. You know, that cuts through any political, any sexual, any racial lines. You know, it is our souls together. It's a phenomenal thing, and I saw that there were a lot of newcomers here tonight. And I know that a lot of this sounds like, you know, when I was new and I was listening to people talk, that had any kind of time, I would just go, "What the hell are you talking about?" Just shut up. But it really is, and as simple as just don't get loaded today. You know, I don't think that's enough. Because I think the most important step in this whole bloody thing is number four. Because I think without that, we're able to continually bullshit ourselves much longer than we absolutely should. And I bullshitted myself all my life. And I wanted to get honest with me because I knew that there was no other way for me to live. And when guys would tell me, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you stay sober, I thought, well, that's a pretty good answer. But I do believe it's more than that. I do believe it's important that we move beyond that. I do believe that is the launching pad for my life. But unless I'm sober, I have no choices whatsoever. But once I stay sober, this talks about the fourth step, and it says, if temperamentally we are on the depressive side, we are apt to be swamped with guilt and self-loathing, shamelessness. We wallow in this messy bog, often getting a misshapen and painful pleasure out of it. As we morbidly pursue this melancholy activity, when we sink to such a point of despair that nothing but oblivion looks possible as a solution. Here, of course, we have lost all perspective and therefore all genuine humility. For this is pride in reverse. If, however, our natural disposition is inclined to self-righteousness or grandiosity, we will be offended at AA's suggested inventory. No doubt we shall point with pride to the good lives we thought we led before the bottle cut us down. We shall claim that our serious character defects, if we think we have any at all, have been caused chiefly by excessive drinking. This being so, we think it logically follows that sobriety, first, last, and all the time, is the only thing we need to work for. We believe that our one-time good characters will be revived the moment we quit alcohol. If we were pretty nice people all along, except for our drinking, what need be there for a moral inventory now that we are sober? Well, it's a real, real important, you know, because I can lie to me easier than I can even lie to you. And I can lie to you pretty damn easily, you know. And if I'm unwilling to really open myself up to myself, you know, and that's, being Catholic, it's easy for me to deal with that part of it because I went to confession all my life. I loved it, actually. He was a person in a room listening only to me. And he had to forgive me. But if you do nothing else, I think the idea of sitting down and honestly and forthrightly looking at those things, you know, if we all take 30 seconds here and just scan across our lives, I know with me there are these peaks of desolation and despair and embarrassment and anger that just are always there, you know, the big ones, the really large evidence of how what insane lives we led, you know, and all of us had different ones. Several of mine include Frank Sinatra, and I don't want to get into that. But and when I was willing to sit down and really examine myself and take responsibility, not guilt, but responsibility for everything I had done in my life, then I was able to look at myself in present time and say, now, do you want to continue doing that or not? Because you can. You know, you absolutely can. And we've all heard this, I'm sure, the definition of insanity that an old man once told me when I was newly sober is the repetition of the same action expecting different results. You know, that's how my drinking life was. You know, today's only going to be 2 beers at Musso Frank's, and that's it, I promise. Then it's 3 o'clock, and you go, you know what, maybe just one tequila. And that's all. Just, I don't like the way that beer tastes. And then it'd be 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was in some fat bastard's heel in the Hollywood Hills, paying $120 for Italian baby laxative, you know. And I would crawl home at 7 o'clock in the morning and be so ashamed to go into the house that I would go into the garage and crawl up in an oil stain somewhere in the corner until my family woke up and they left the house. And my son would be driven to school by his mother. My daughter would go to school and I would crawl into the house and get back into bed and sleep till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Maybe just 2 beers and some friends, that's all three. And that went on for years. It's wonderful to remember. It would be horrible to repeat. I am married to the same woman today. We've been married for over 20 years. We have 4 children together. We have an 8-year-old son. She has stayed with me. She's a true Al-Anon. Trust me, if she's ever had a plane crash right before the ground, if the plane hits the ground, somebody else's life will flash before her eyes. But you know what? Only next to me, she saved my life more than I did. She stayed. You know, she looked at me one day and she says, I understand you'd like to die, but would you just please not do it in front of the children? She's English. She doesn't believe in divorce. Homicide, yes, but not divorce. The script is part of her. And today we have a spectacular relationship. I am successful in my business. I have beaten the odds at many turns in my life. But I know enough about me to know that if I think more of anything is the solution to my problem, that's when I get into trouble. More is not the answer. I think really, truly, for me, less is the answer. In 1985, I tell the story a lot, but it just so points to the alcoholic personality, at least mine. I won an Emmy Award for acting for the show I used to do, and went to the award show that night, nominated. You know, didn't know I'd win, and I was feeling great, nervous, obviously, wanting to. If they don't give it to me, does that mean I'm a piece of crap? And different stuff. And I was so. And they called my name. Got up on the stage, and for the first time in my life, I felt the imposter had left. Now this was me. Now so here I was, where I belonged. 50 million people watching me on television. I've got this great gold statue in my hand. I am the best. I left the stage. And I walked out of the auditorium with my beautiful wife on my arm, and I got into my beautiful limousine, and I drove to my beautiful house by the Pacific Ocean. I walked in, and I took this statue, and I placed it on my mantelpiece, and I stepped back, and my very next thought was, you know, I need one on the other end just to balance it off. When I start thinking like that, I'm unable to really understand the gifts that I have in my life, you know? I mean, I got 3 more, but that's another story. progress, not perfection, okay? If you're new to this journey, please don't take anything I say seriously. Find out for yourself. The only thing I know is the experience that I have had in the time that I have been sober. The only story I know is mine and how it applies to my life and how it applies to my daily living in this world of insanity and debauchery and evil and anger and violence. I don't have to participate in any of that. All I have to do is make sure that I understand that I have a daily reprieve from a situation that was not... I did not volunteer for this. No, I didn't wake up when I was 7 years old and say, I want to be an alcoholic when I grow up. I am an alcoholic. I was born an alcoholic. And I have the opportunity on a daily basis not to act like one. and I love that opportunity. And some days it fails. You know, I'm in a business where people are paid to satisfy my ego. You know, their jobs depend upon satisfying me. And that's a real dangerous place for an alcoholic to be. You know, because I can get very righteous about it, and I can be very justified in it. And I'll tell you something, that in the time that I've been sober, the number of times, considering my position, that I've walked up to a grip, which is a guy that like pulls cables and stuff on the set, or a prop man, that something was wrong and I blew up in the moment. To walk up to one of these guys and look at them and say, you know what, I was really an asshole. And I'm really sorry. Is there something I can do? You know, you need me time off? What do you need? I just want to let you know how badly I felt about that. What a remarkable experience that is. Well, I don't have to stand behind that righteousness anymore. You know, I can just look at you and admit that I was absolutely and totally wrong, that I neglected to look at you as a fellow human being, regardless of whether you're a drunk or not, you know, because I believe this is a schoolroom and there's life out there. Now, I've got to treat those people like I'm willing to treat you. Otherwise, I'm only half alive. I really do believe that. So if you're new, please go to meetings. Become aware of your opportunity here. You know, each day is an opportunity to feel better about yourself. And there are a lot of people around here who have been feeling good about themselves for a long time. The book is a miraculous thing. I don't need any of you if I have the book. What's great about having you is that I get to reflect on its truth through your experience, which gives me a whole new dimension, you know. It's like watching five different guys do Hamlet. I see five different interpretations of a great thing. By listening to your lives, I get an opportunity to reflect on mine and realize that I can enrich it because there are people in this room who I envy. You know, there are people in this room who I admire, and I don't even know you. You know, the idea that someone can stay sober for 20 years and not become Clancy. I'm just glad he's not the only all-timer around, I'll tell you that. I've taken up much of your time. I want to thank Craig again for allowing me to come down here and share my experience. I do love you, and I don't even know you, but I love that part of you that is me that both reflects my disease and my cure. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be here tonight. I want to thank the committee or whoever puts on this thing for inviting me and for you. I've been in town, went down and had dinner tonight at the beautiful hotel right in downtown Fresno, and looking up over the many floors up over the ground. It's just wonderful to be in Fresno. I don't know whether you feel like it's wonderful to be in Fresno, but you got to not be in Fresno for a long time to think like it's wonderful to be in Fresno, and I haven't been in Fresno for a real long time. So it's wonderful to be in Fresno. I'm a real alcoholic, and it's great to be in an AA meeting. It's an honor to be in an AA meeting, and it's a distinct honor to be asked to speak anywhere at any time about our fellowship. It's awfully cold. Don't you agree tonight that it's cold? Am I the only person in the room that's cold? I'm cold. I think the antifreeze has all gone out of me, and it's hard to get used to being on the antifreeze, but I'm not. But we're gonna warm up to the subject here. I think I'll start at the beginning. I was born thirsty. I was born in the same year that Alcoholics Anonymous got started. In fact, I was born a few months before the program got started. I was born in February of 1935, and in June, on June 10th, Bob and Bill got together and back in Ohio, and that was the very first meeting between anybody in the whole world. So I was lying over in Arizona from February to June waiting for those guys to get some kind of program started, because I really do believe that I'm one of those kinds of people that came onto the globe an alcoholic. They told me that in the hospital that I went to, but I firmly believe it. I don't, you know, they talk about crossing a line or things getting bad, or, you know, you drink for a while and things begin to crowd in on you. My experience was that I started running. I never remember having a social drink. I have four older brothers, all of them alcoholics. two of them have died from the direct result of our disease. One of my brothers has been able to stay sober for many years due to religion, and my hat is off to him. Bill Wilson tells us that ours is not the only way, but it certainly is a preferred way. But anyway, as I grew up and started going to school, and just like all of us, I found out when I was just a very young guy, about 11 years old, my family went back to the family farm back in Wisconsin, back in Marion, Wisconsin. And there was a great number of beer drinkers and stuff around there, and I'm just an 11-year-old kid. But I had a cousin back on the farm, and he felt kind of sorry for me because I was just the little kid that never got anything to drink. And he told me one day, he says, come here, I want to show you something. He took me out into this barn, this beautiful farm back in Wisconsin. And back in Wisconsin, they cut hay and stuff in the few summer months before the winter, and they put it out in the barn for the stock to eat all winter long. And he showed me a hole that he made in the hay, and way back as far as you could reach, the whole length of my arm, he had bought me a quart bottle of Virginia Dare wine. And he says, now I'll tell you what, John, he said, this guy's about 22 years old, but he said, I went downtown today and I bought this bottle of wine, and it's right here in this hole, and you're the only one that knows about it, and anytime you'd like to have a drink, and the grown-ups are drinking, just come out, sneak out to the barn, and you can have a drink. And he says, I got a whole quart, we were going to be there all summer. He says, I'm sure it'll last the whole summer for you, you know, and that way I can have a nip. He's just being kind of a gentlemanly guy. That night, the bottle was gone. I drank the whole thing in one day, 11-year-old kid, got completely bottled, peed my pants, went downtown to where they were having a movie, went into the ladies' room, stuffed up the toilet, and it overflowed. The manager was mad at me. I made a complete fool out of myself on my very first shot. The next day, here I am, an 11-year-old kid, throwing up, sick as a dog, and that was the beginning of my drinking career. That's how I kind of like eased into things. And that's just the way it was. Now I'm one of those alcoholics though that was able to be what I guess what they call a working or a vertical alcoholic. I was able to continue on through school, and I was shortly afterwards, by the way, on that trip to Wisconsin at the end of that particular year, that was in 1946, I did get really sick, and I got polio, and that's why I'm in a wheelchair today, because I got polio back just about 3 years before they invented the polio vaccine. So the reason I'm handicapped is because of poliomyelitis, infantile paralysis, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, I went, that was all right. It worked out fine. I got out of the hospital after a couple of years, went to high school, and was very, very interested in all the things that happened in school. I ran for all the... I was president of this and president of that, president of the band. I was student body president. Just had a wonderful time. But about every second or third weekend, I would get drunk. Never had a social drink. I could never kind of ease into it. I always drank too much and got drunk and had something unpleasant happen. Usually some kind of a lack of control of my kidneys or a little bit of a wreck or something or broke something or knocked something over. I was constantly in trouble, but I couldn't put the two together. When I didn't drink, I was a pretty good student and a nice guy, and I worked, everything seemed to go along just fine, but these things kept creeping up on me and having too much to drink and having these problems. But these are all through the teenage years. When I got out of high school, I fell in love with the broadcasting business, which is another story, and I went to a radio engineering school, learned how to become an engineer and a broadcast engineer, got into broadcasting and television. Oh, it was just wonderful. It was just perfect. It was great to be, I was in a wheelchair, I didn't have to walk because I could talk on the radio and broadcast sporting events, etc., and was making a good living. But even then, I would notice every once in a while, I'd overshoot that mark. I didn't want to. I loved my work. I loved being in broadcasting. I just wanted to be a nice guy, but I kept going with the guys and have a few drinks, and I was always the one that seemed to end up going into a blackout and crossing over and going too far and have hangovers. My God, I used to have the most horrible, terrible, debilitating, throwing up, bad stomach, Jesus, for a couple of days. Swear I'd never drink again. And of course, I always drank again. And I always able to work pretty good too, continued to work. And then I fell in love one time
I'm doing this whole thing so I can get into my sober, because I'm going to talk about my sober life and the drunk life. But I went into this world of broadcasting, and in 1958, I'll never forget, I fell in love accidentally with politics. Those of you who, this great state of California, which is a fabulous political state, back in 1958, there was an enormous upwelling of interest in our state about unionism. The Republicans wanted to do away with unions. They had a thing called right to work. And the Democrats and all the labor unions and everybody came up and killed this bill called right to work. And I was just, I was born in 35, this is 58, so figured out I was like 23, 24 years of age. And I got interested in this thing and began to work a little bit in politics. Met everybody, Pat Brown and all the people who were running for office. And I got very interested in public life and decided to run for office, my God. And I did that. I got elected. Still can't believe it. Actually went out and talked to people and BS'd a little bit. And back in 1959. And it was just wonderful. I just couldn't believe what a wonderful honor that was. And I can remember there was a guy who was the city mayor, a guy named Raymond H. Gregory, got elected at the same time. And he called me up to the house a couple of days before we were sworn into office, gave me a book. And he says, John, they tell me that I get to appoint members of the city council with certain boards and commissions. And he says, you and I are going in together. I don't know those guys down there. They've all been there for a while. But I feel kind of in a kinship toward you. So he said, I want you to look through this book, and you can pick four appointments that you want, and I'll give them to you, and then I'll give the rest of them to the other guys. Seems fair to me. So I'm leaping through the book, and there's all interesting things like public buildings and parks and finance committee and all this stuff. And I look down and turn the page, police commissioner, it says. Police commissioner. God damn, that had a ring to it, you know? I said, I'd like that one right there. You got it. So the next Monday, we were sworn into office. I go over to the San Bernardino City Police Department, right where they booked the prisoners. They booked me, except that what they were doing is to take my picture for a laminated card, bring it out to me. I still have it at home, beautiful card like this. John P. Quimby, Police Commissioner, City of San Bernardino. Now, if that wasn't wonderful, I put that bugger in my pocket, and away we go. That's just, let me tell you something, you do not, I find out, get arrested for drunk driving in the city of San Bernardino when you're the police commissioner. Isn't that wonderful? I don't know how it worked, but just nobody ever arrested me. Believe me, I didn't stop drinking because I still had that annoying habit of going for one or two weeks or three and maybe, and then I'd hit that time where I would go on over that line, make a fool out of myself, throw up, fall down, get into some kind of trouble. But now I had someone to drive me home. I served for 4 years in that position, enjoyed it, loved it very much. When I found out that the man who was the state assemblyman had decided to run up for a higher office, called me up and offered if I could run for that office. This is in 1962, and I said, why not? Let's go. And I'll be a son of a gun, ladies and gentlemen. I know it's going to be hard for you to believe, but I'm here tonight to tell you that in the June primary of that year, 1973 or whatever it was, 63 rather, 62, I've been elected to the California State Legislature. I'm only 26, 27 years old. I still got this. I'm married at that time. I met a lovely lady, and I actually was married for my second time. The first one, I couldn't hardly see go by. But the second one, I'm married to this very impressive lady. Got two or three little kids. I'm working at the radio station. I got a nice name. I'm the city police commissioner. I'm the son of a gun. If the people in that county didn't elect me to the state assembly. I took office on January 1st, 1963. That was back in the days before what they call full-time legislature. So you can take your wife and kids. Everybody would go to Sacramento for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months. And I came up to Sacramento and got sworn in. And there was Pat Brown, my old friend, who was the governor, and all these people. And I, you know, as an alcoholic, with an alcoholic personality, and all of this incredibleness that most of us have, which is a superior feeling, but with an inferiority complex, you can imagine how I felt. I was surprised that I was there. I couldn't believe that I was there. But on the other hand, I was a kind of an ego, self-centered, healthy on one side, and it was a very mind-blowing thing. But what the hell, I took the oath of office, got sworn into office, and here I am in this California legislature. They give me a beautiful car. I'll never forget. I'd always wanted a Thunderbird. And the guy comes to see me and he says, now we have what we call the state auto, the assembly automobile program. You can have any car you want. I mean, any car you want. And I said, can I have a black Thunderbird? You got it. It was a 1963 black Seabird. Any of you remember that with the humps? God, what a machine. And it had license plates on it that said, member, California Legislature, 872. Now, this was in the days, it isn't true now, but in those days, Anita, the legislature set the salaries of the highway patrol. It was entirely up to the legislature. California highway patrolmen didn't arrest assemblymen in those days. They do today now because they don't set, not just because of that, but for other reasons. But on the drive, when I said I hadn't been to Fresno for a long time, I used to come through this town, I hate to admit it. It's one of the statues. This is being taped right now, I'm just kidding. I would come through this town, you know, 9,500 miles an hour. Remember one time between here and Bakersfield, I forget what time, I was driving toward Southern California, and it began to rain. And I turned the windshield wipers on, and they wouldn't work. They were going back and forth, but it didn't work. And I looked down, and I was going 100 miles an hour. And what the trouble was that the wind would hit the windshield and move the blade up off of its glass. So I had to slow down to about 70 before the rubber would come down and touch the glass as it went back and forth. Arrogant dude. Let me say one thing. I want to interject one little thing here because I get to talking about alcoholism and alcoholics and how bad it was. The truth is, during all this time, you know what? I was a great member of the legislature. I really loved serving. I was a good member. I did contribute a great deal to the state of California, and I'm very, very proud of the fact that I was in both on the city council and a member of the legislature. As I talk and kid and joke about those times and kind of self-defacing, run-down stories that I hope you'll identify with, I do want you to know that I did go to work every day. I worked hard as hell, and I was a good member of the legislature. But I was also this booming, budding, oncoming alcoholic. And these times when I would run over the line, used to be every 2 or 3 weeks, now it was getting to be 120 members of the legislature and about 800 or 900 registered lobbyists. And those lobbyists' job, still to this day, then, was to give anything that they could to get the attention and the good feeling of the legislature. That's what they were paid to do. And it was just, My drinking continued, but I kind of went up the scale on the things I drank. Good whiskey and good cigars and a good time with that by all in the evening hours. And I drank, got to drink so much that I finally, in the election of 1974, actually didn't even campaign. I was so screwed up. My wife had left me by this time, gotten mad and took off. And my alcoholism got to the point where I couldn't function. And luckily, and I thank God tonight, and I have 100 times since, people did not vote for me in the June primary election of 1974 simply because I didn't campaign. I was too drunk and too screwed up in order to go out and put on any kind of a campaign, and I was thrown out of office. Well, that was in June of 74, and I didn't leave office till the end of that year. And my attitude at that time was those dirty, rotten, no good, lousy people that didn't vote for wonderful me, the hell with them. I just had this terrible feeling of rejection and anger. And I really poured the coal on, drank almost to death from that day until the 15th day of September 1976, which is my sobriety day. It'll be 25 years this year. I mean, in Sacramento. In Sacramento, then, they used to have a hospital that actually treated the disease of alcoholism. It wasn't, you didn't have to sneak in there with a bad liver or something. It was called the care unit, and you went right to the front door and gave your name, and that's what happened to me. My son checked me in, called the hospital, and signed me up, and I went out there. My last drink was, I guess, the 14th of September. I finished off the rest of a bottle of Jack Daniels in the parking lot of that hospital. And went in there and submitted myself to whatever the heck they want to talk about. I hadn't had a bath for about a month. I had a broken arm. This arm was broken. I didn't even know it. You know, you got two bones there between your wrist and your elbow. Both of them were busted. I didn't know it. And I just was a real mess. I was, of course, in the wheelchair. I didn't have a power chair in those days. So I've got one busted arm and sitting in a wheelchair. And when you have a broken arm and you're in a hand-controlled wheelchair, and you can only use one arm, all you do is go around in circles. So that's what I've been doing, I guess. I just go around in circles. So they got me in there and got me in bed and cleaned me up and gave me a shower and all this stuff and got the medical stuff done that they had to do. And one of the things that they suggested at this care unit, all what they would do during the day is you'd go to lots of lectures about what the World Health Organization has to say about the disease of alcoholism and how alcohol affects the liver and all of this stuff, which is all very, very interesting and wonderful, and I remember it distinctly. But one of the things that they strongly suggested that we do was go to an AA meeting every Sunday night. I had never in my life heard of AA. I think I'd read about it in a magazine one time, and I just heard people joking about it. But can you believe to hear a member of the legislature, a former member of city councilman, a guy in broadcasting, had never heard of AA, but I really hadn't in 1976. I'd heard of it, kind of like you hear about the Rosicrucians and the Rotarians and the, you know, the Auto Club. I had some vague idea that there was a group called AA, but I didn't know what it was. I'd never been to a meeting. I didn't know a thing about it. And the reason I dwell on that is because if I had known anything about it, I probably would have formed a bad opinion. But I was lucky enough that I didn't know what it was. I thought, what the hell, I'll go to one of those AA meetings. It was on Sunday night in the cafeteria at the Mercy San Juan Hospital in Carmichael. Went down there. And it was a meeting room smaller than this, but not different from you tonight, not different from us. Same bunch-looking folks sitting around having a meeting. And I went to the meeting, and I sat and listened to it, and the unit was upstairs, and all the patients would come down and go to the meeting. There was nothing particularly interesting that was said. I don't remember. I kind of guess I heard him read the steps. I didn't really identify with anything. I kept waiting for something to be said or done or some rote or maybe some hidden handshake or a secret word of some kind. Nothing really. I think it was on the second step, and there was probably 35 or 40 people that they kind of shared, you know, a couple of laughs here and there and some real bad coffee. Everybody smoked in those days, so the whole room was full of smoke. An hour and a half meeting. And they got up, said the Lord's Prayer, which is a little bit difficult for me. It was a little bit uncomfortable that to hold hands and pray, but I was able to get through that. Went back up to the unit, didn't think anything about it. It was just, you know, it was nothing all that fabulous about it, frankly. Went through all the whole next week of lectures, and then the next Sunday night went down to the same thing. So I've been in the hospital for 4 weeks. I went to 4 meetings. Nothing really profound that I could figure out. Still hadn't figured. I hadn't heard about that, but I went every week. And about 3 months, it suddenly dawned on me, for some reason that I'm still unable to tell you, I had lost the compulsion to drink. I didn't even think about it. It hadn't even dawned on me. It just simply happened. There was a magic for me just by attending AA meetings where I was miraculously relieved of this obsession to drink. Because prior to that, I was a daily blackout, pant-pissing, drunken mess. Up until the day when I took that last drink of Jack Daniels in the parking lot on the 14th of September, and about 2 or 3 months, I used to hear people, I'd sit in that meeting, and there usually was a little lady, I remember she would knit. I thought she was knitting a tarp for the infield at the Dodger Stadium or something. I don't know what she was doing, but she was always knitting. And they would call on her, and she would say something like, when I came through those doors, God miraculously took from me the compulsion to drink. And I would think to myself, I can confess to you now, I'd say to myself, I wonder why they let those demented old bastards in the meeting. She sits around here and clicks those goddamn knitting needles all the time. And then they call on her, and she all says the same thing. God miraculously took for me the compulsion to drink. I mean, can't we have, why didn't she tell us something? Yeah, I was really a negative, rotten, self-centered bird. But then, now, man, about that third and a half month, it dawned on me one day, she was telling my story. I just came to AA, and God miraculously removed from me my desire to drink. I hadn't had a drink for three months, and I hadn't needed to have a drink. I didn't want to have a drink. I hadn't actually even thought about it. It just kind of went away. Isn't that a miraculous thing? Because you know what? That is a very, very common story that we hear about. We get here, many of us get here in different ways. The way I got here, I've just told you. Of course, it was just the beginning. I did continue to go to meetings. I always have gone to meetings. I go to 3 meetings a week now. And I continued to go and go. And I want to tell you that during about the third or fourth month of my sobriety and going back to the hospital at Mercy San Juan Hospital in Sacramento, and that's where we met a long, long, long time ago, 23, 24, almost 25 years ago. And boy, she was a very, very, very important part of my early sobriety in those very early days. I owe her an enormous debt of gratitude. Can I ask you to just give Rita another round of applause just for being alive? Eva Mendoza, you have an emergency call. You have an emergency at home. Eva Mendoza, is that the right name?
Yeah.
Are you here, Eva? Well, huh? You know who Eva is? Hi, Eva. You're not Eva, okay. Anyway, thanks for clapping for Rita. I don't have the right to tell her story, but I do want you to know that she's a very important part of my story and that we were together very, very early on, and she taught me a lot about the program in those early days. And boy, was I green and unknowing and unknown. I really didn't know what the hell was happening, but I just didn't drink. The only thing that I did right was that I didn't drink, and I went to a lot of meetings. And that was the foundation, the beginning of my sobriety, which has been continuous for almost 25 years. But you know, one of the things that has occurred to me in recent years is how wrong I was at that time about some things, and that's what I really want to share with you tonight. I was one of the people that really believed, I know this now, I didn't know it then, but I know it now. I really believed that I was a pretty good guy, basically, had very few problems. My problem was that I drank alcohol. And that my problem was as a drinking alcoholic, that was screwing up my life. And I was making bad mistakes and doing bad things behind my drinking. And so it occurred to my fascinating mind that if I didn't drink alcohol, if that could be removed from me, then everything would be great. Everything would be fine. I would be that nice guy, that well-adjusted sweetheart of a dude, and everything would be great. And I labored under that delusion for about 15 years in AA. Because what happened is, my story, to tell you the truth, it ain't your story, it's my story. And that's the only story I got, so I got to share it. What happened to me was, I didn't drink anymore. I steadfastly did not drink. I did continue to go to meetings. I did sponsor even a few people. I got a sponsor. I did all the things that I heard I was supposed to do. But a fundamental thing didn't change, and that is that I didn't change in the areas of life that had constantly given me the most trouble. My problem was, and I found it in the fifth step in the 12x12, I was incapable of fashioning a relationship with another human being. What I did was, everybody that I would meet, I would marry. I have been married, and I've been married 6 times. I've been divorced 5 times. I was married and divorced so many times that I have rice pockmarks right here on the side of my. And I thought, when I got into AA and got sober, I really sincerely thought to myself, God damn, finally, this is over. I've been married and divorced three times drunk. And now that's what the problem was. So I got married again, and this ended about 5 years. It ended. It ended in divorce. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. Or, the three drunk marriages and divorces, I kind of figured that. But a sober marriage and divorce, I really had a hard time swallowing that one. But, you know, it was painful, it was expensive, and all the stuff. And I tripped along, and pretty soon I met this lovely, comely young lady from Lodi, and I got married again. And finally, this is it. This is it! I mean, you know, what the hell, five times? It ended in divorce. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. I really goddamn couldn't believe it. It almost killed me. I'm 50 years clean and sober in AA. I go to three meetings a week. I put $2 in the collection plate every time I come to class. Not one. $2. I'm sponsoring three guys. I've read the guy. I even read as Bill sees it. I mean, you know, what else can I do? I thought I was going to die. I really thought I was going to die. I finally began to read some of the literature. I want to commend one to you tonight that I read. Anybody ever read a thing called the 12 and 12, 12 steps? You know, Bill Wilson wrote that 12 and 12 when he was about 15 years sober. In the big book, in our beautiful big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the sixth step and the seventh step have about one paragraph each. You know, just kind of mentioned as he moves by. Because it was written in, what, 1938 or 39? Well, they only had 3 or 4 years sobriety. They had the steps, but they didn't, you know, I mean, they hadn't, nobody really worked them, I guess. Don't get me wrong. I love the big book of AA. I think it's the most fabulous piece of literature of the 20th century. But when he got around to writing the 12 and 12, there he had about 12, 15, 16 years of sobriety, and the man had really been through it. And in the seventh step, that fabulous seventh step, in the 12 and 12, I'm reading this booker, and it says in there, sometimes we have to go through a painful process of ego puncturing. Painful process. It's at the end of a long road that we finally get to this part where we are ready to reach for humility because we want it, rather than having to be bludgeoned and beaten into it. Now, I used to read that and I thought, God, to be bludgeoned and beaten into it. Now, I used to read that, and I thought, God, damn, he was being a little dramatic, you know? That was I just thought, you know, the man was getting kind of being a little... But let me tell you something. When I read that, at that year of my 15th year of sobriety, the year of my fifth divorce, my second sober divorce, bludgeoned and beaten into humility was just about to despair. In fact, he uses another term in there called groveling despair. I couldn't understand what groveling, and that's where I was. You know what? This probably isn't your story. I don't think that it happens to too many people, but I just got to tell you tonight, it happened to me. I was finally brought to my knees. I didn't know what to do. I went down. I'll tell you how bad off I was. I couldn't drive. I was in as bad a physical shape behind this emotional Waterloo that I'd reached as I'd ever been behind drinking. I had to have a girl who worked for me, my secretary, drive me. I called up and made arrangements to go into a hospital in Southern California that Claudia Black runs. She wrote a book called It'll Never Happen to Me, a wonderful lady. And I had to have my secretary drive me down there because I was unable to drive the car to Southern California. I literally couldn't do it. I hadn't been eating. I was a mess. I was a mess. And I got down there and I went into this hospital in Southern California. Now, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, they had me doing things down there that I goddamn guarantee you I would never have done if you'd have had a gun on me. Those limp-wristed faggots had me talking to my inner child. Can you believe that? I mean, I tell you one thing, there used to be an ACA meeting out there in Roseville, and people would sneak into that meeting carrying little teddy bears. Have you ever done an ACA or the packs of teddy bear with them? Wrong people with their own teddy bear. I used to hold those folks in real low regard. I got myself a teddy bear. I'm at that hospital down there, and this psychiatrist says to me, you have to get in touch with your inner child. Now, I knew that that guy had the key. If I didn't get in touch with my inner child, he ain't gonna let me out of here. So my motivation was to do whatever the hell it was that guy said. And you know what? I started, and he said, once a day, John, I want you to go somewhere on this campus that was down in Cerrito, all alone, and talk to your inner child. He gave me a little script to read. I've written on a yellow pad. And I would go sneak away, you know, outside something, and I would read that to my inner child and mean it. And you know, I began to feel the presence of that inner child. And another thing he said to me was, I want you to write to your inner child. Can you believe that? I mean, I get a little bit back of my neck wiggles when I think about writing a letter. But anyway, he says, I want you to take a pen in your right hand, whatever your dominant hand is, and write a letter to your inner child. A very simple, loving letter. And then put the pen in your left hand, and he'll write back. I figured this guy. I was really worried. But when nobody was looking, I wrote a letter. Dear John, I want you to know that I love you. I want you to know that you can come out and play. You are safe. I don't remember all the lyrics, but it was just something. I love you. I want to provide a safe home for you. Whatever the line was. And I put the pen in my left hand, and folks began to write back. It was real scrawly, hard to read, but I actually got a few words. I wasn't thinking of it. My hand. It's almost like a Ouija board. Anybody here ever play with a Ouija board? You know what I'm saying? My hand started to move. I'm getting the letter back from this bugger. It was almost scary. Then these little reading things that I had began to take on a kind of a spiritual essence. So I was getting serious about it now. I would go away from all the other patients and kind of hide in an unused room and read to my inner child. And I get this feeling. Another thing that they had me do was I had to write a letter to my dead father. My dad had died in 1951. And then I had to write a letter to all of my relatives. But the tough part is I had to read those letters to the assembled all of the patients in the hospital. I just thought it was a terrible thing to do. My dad had been dead since 1951. I'm going to write him a letter. So I had to do it. So I wrote the letter, you know. And then it come the day for me to read that letter. And I got that letter out and I had to read it to the class. And about halfway through the reading back of this letter, I began to have these feelings of emotion and grief and sobbing like I hadn't done, I don't know, remember when. And it was a real cleansing. I'm not advocating any of this, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just telling you what happened to me. Well, I was down there for 5 weeks. Alone, Carmichael, and I got a nice swimming pool in the backyard. And I used to think to myself about my grandkids. I hate it when those little bastards come over here because, you know, they rub peanut butter on the screens and they grab my cat by the tail and they break things. I just didn't like kids. I didn't want the little bastards around. I hate them in a restaurant downtown, but I didn't want them to come. This is before I went away. Now I'm back and I'm sitting in my backyard and I'm thinking to myself, everything about this backyard is perfect. The lawn is mowed, hedge is trimmed, there's a guy that comes and cleans the pool, you can read a 25-cent piece of bait all the way through the water. It was nothing out of place, it was just sterile and neat and terrible. I'd have given anything if one of those grandkids would come over and swim in the pool. But they're not going to come over and swim in the grandpa's house because they could tell they didn't like them. So what I did was, I started calling them up one by one. I'd take them on a pizza. And the funny thing is, I found out that I love children. I love babies. I always hated them. I liked W.C. Fields, who said that he hated kids. You know, I had a big picture of W.C. Fields in my garage. And remember that, I love that picture about him holding that kid on the golf course, you know, trying to strangle him. All of a sudden, that didn't seem funny to me anymore. All of a sudden, I had this wonderful, warm, compassionate, loving feeling for children. And I now think that that's because I'd come to terms with this inner child, I guess. I don't know. I really don't know the answer. All I do know is that I fell in love with this wonderful collection of people called my own grandchildren. I've got 11 grandchildren. They are fabulous. A bunch of them are mine for my kids. A bunch of them are from my wife and her kids. But anyway, they're just all over the place. And you know what? They're clean. They're neat. They're intelligent. They're smart. They're lovely. God damn, they're great kids. I would take two or three of them, and we'd get in the car and take trips and drive over to Las Vegas for a week. We just went out to the Boulder Dam. We went down to Palm Springs. I took them all down to that that thing down there by L.A. with all those rides up in the sky. What do you call it? 12 flags or something. I personally can't stand the goddamn rides, but the kids loved it. We got a hotel room, a couple of rooms, and they just had a ball. They ranged in age from about 4 to about 15 years of age. And I fell in love with these bunch of human beings that were my own grandchildren. Because, I guess, I had gotten rid of the anger and the hate of in the pit of my stomach about myself. I finally had gotten to the point where I could reach out with humility and love and embrace my own family. The pride and the ego and the anger and the self-centeredness had AA opened the door for me to be teachable enough to do that one thing has meant so very, very, very much to my life today. I was able to finally, believe it or not, I know you're wondering, I had known this lady for a very long time, but I had never had any emotional or romantic feeling about her. We'd been at AA. She was the general secretary of the Roosevelt Group. And we would go out to dinner once in a while, and we did fall in love and married. I'll be married 4 years this August to a lovely lady named Linda. We haven't had any fights. There's no battle going on. The war is over. The fights are done. It is really, I believe, been a miraculously cleansing thing for me to go through. And I want to tell you, I know that there are places in AA where they get mad if you talk about things like inner child work and all that kind of stuff, but it's my story, and it happened to me, and I know that I would never have been able to think about it or open the door to it in my mental attitude if it wasn't for the fact that I had this basic training in the love and the miracle of AA. I remember reading, and some of you do too, that our founder, Bill W., suffered himself from great anger and great depression. I read one time that Bill Wilson would go to bed, had been in bed for a week, with paralyzed with the depression that he couldn't get out of. And I believe it was Father Dowling who came to see him from Detroit one time, and he said he wanted to meet the great Bill Wilson, and they took him in the back room, and there laying in bed was Bill Wilson, laying in bed, bedridden because of the depression. And he began to talk to Father Dowling, and Father Dowling says, Bill, your problem is that you wrote the steps, but you haven't done the steps. And he says, what you need to do is to do a four-step inventory, do all these things. Now, that must have been really humiliating for Bill. I mean, after all, he was a great, wonderful Mr. Bill, but he did do it at Father Dowling's suggestions, and because of that, was able to have the kind of love and spirit in him that helped him to write those passages that I referred to opened up through pain, to be able to read that part about the end of a long, long road of painful ego puncturing. And the painful ego puncturing in our child, etc. But it worked. That suggests one thing to me, that my mind has got to be open for all the rest of the wonderful gifts that can be mine as I continue trudging my road to happy destiny. Well, I had another one that completely forgot about. I want to tell you what I'm doing now, and because AA has helped me out so much in all of my life. At about the time I got out of the hospital setting there, and I'm telling you about it, I've been thrown out of public office. People wisely got the hell rid of me. But I sobered up, and I was sober, and I went downtown to figure out how to earn a living, and I was able to get a job as a lobbyist. Now, I'm one of those lobbyists that I talked about earlier, the buzz on the booth. I do occasionally buy booze, but it isn't really part of the job so much anymore. So I've been working for the last 20-some-odd years in Sacramento as a lobbyist. And I represent counties. I represent San Bernardino County and Riverside County, which is wonderful because they're just far enough away that I don't have to see them that often, and that's just kind of a joke. I don't mind seeing them. I'm experienced. I want to. But I do represent those two counties down at the state capitol, and I take care of all the affairs that have any interest to them. And let me tell you the funny thing. Here's the funny thing for me. I don't know whether this is coincidence. I don't know what it means, but it causes my stomach to twitter almost with joy when I think about it. The man who is the big boss at the county, the top number one guy, gray-haired, very distinguished-looking kind of a dude. If you were walking in the room tonight, you'd grab your wallet. I mean, he really looked good. 17 years in AA. The guy's a real rock-ripped, fabulous member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that had nothing to do with it. It just happened. I met the guy. I couldn't believe it. What a sweet guy he is. His name is Tom. The man who is the number one chief of all the law enforcement down there has got about 2 years clean and sober in AA. And these guys go to meetings. They go to 6:30 a.m. attitude adjustment meetings. Can you believe that? I didn't even know anybody was up at 6:30 in the morning. I used to go on being on my way home at 6:30. I cannot go to early morning meetings. But they get up twice a week and go to early AA meetings down in Riverside County. Then they go down and run the county government. They are wonderful guys. They're just regular guys like you and I, but they have been very successful in life, but they're really God-fearing, loving, program-loving members of AA. It is wonderful to be with them, to work down there with them, and to have the joy and the thrill of meeting guys, you know, at work, and then you find out one little word or something or an attitude or a bumper strip, I don't remember how it happened, and bang, you find out that they're also members of AA. It is wonderful to be surrounded. I work down at the Capitol every day. The man who was the head of the Senate now, who's a wonderful fellow, many of you may have read his name in the papers, Senator John Burton. Johnny is an old friend of mine from many, many years ago, and he's a very astute defender of the program. He's a member of NA, has been for many, many years. His sponsor is Wilbur Mills, former chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. And the guy, I didn't even know. I was going down the street in Sacramento one night. I heard this guy screaming out of a car. And I thought I was hearing an echo or something. And I could hear this voice and it yelling, "Rarely ever seen a person fail as thoroughly fall on our bed." And I looked at his Burton hanging out the back door of this car yelling at me, and it was his way of saying, "Hi, how are you? We're both in the fellowship." And this guy runs the Senate. There are several members now of the legislature who are members of our fellowship of AA, actual go to meetings. I mean, these aren't just folks who went to a meeting, but are ongoing members, active participants. When I was there 30 years ago, it seemed to me like everybody drank booze and everybody smoked. Not everybody, but almost everybody. Of course, that was I'm seeing the world through the perception of my eyes. Now, it seems to me like there is a kind of an acceptance of the whole idea of recovery and the fact that it is a fact of life and it can happen downtown while you're going to work every day. Four brothers of mine are alcoholics, two of them died drunk. My dad was an alcoholic. All of his brothers were alcoholics. Everywhere in the whole family, it just seemed to permeate every part of our family. But there's something that I found out that I'm delighted about. That is that recovery also travels through families. It is absolutely uncanny. One person comes into the fellowship, stays in the fellowship, doesn't necessarily 12-step, you don't have to leave tracks laying around, that kind of stuff, and it begins, one seed is planted, and it begins to spread. It's incredible. It is so phenomenal from the perspective of 25 years to look back at the number of people in my family. I have a cousin up in Oregon who was clean and sober. Both of my kids, my son has got going on 8 years in AA. My daughter was clean and sober about 6 years. It's just unbelievable. My wife's son-in-law has now got about 6 months. And there's no pressure. No, we don't leave big books around or dragging the meetings. It's just it seems like the most effective 12-step work we do on families is just to stay sober ourselves and be honest and sincere about our own recovery. And when we think and enjoy and practice our recovery, it has this contagious effect. I'm here to announce tonight that recovery is contagious, and it spreads through families just as much as the disease in prior years spread through families. Isn't that an incredible thing to know? You know, the power of recovery, the power of AA, the power of the spirituality of our program is an enormous thing. It is really an enormous thing. Hero, I've never met her, but Betty Ford is someone who I think is a hero because she has been an active member of the program but has never broken her anonymity at the public level. She once in a while will have like a big book on a table or the steps will be behind her in a photograph or in a TV interview, but she has never broken the anonymity clause. Yet she, I understand, is a very active member of our fellowship. And a very thrilling thing for me was that I got a tape the other day from a friend of mine, and I'm sure you know about this, and at a meeting level we can break anonymity, so I'm not hurting anybody, and it was Tony H., who gave this great talk down in Santa Monica about his life and about his, and it was just a wonderful guy, and it's Anthony Hopkins, that great actor, Hannibal, who's a member of our program, clean and sober, working a great program in our fellowship. And, of course, I'm also excited if I can see the guy next door, or the guy at the meat shop, or the fellow who drives the cab, or the guy, I was somewhere the other day, I was at the airport the other night to pick somebody up, and the cop, there's a black cop, deputy sheriff. You know how when you go to the airport, they seem to be determined to get you the hell out of there, write your ticket, they don't want you to stop or anything, and the announcement is going off overhead, don't leave your car, don't turn off the engine. Well, this police guy is coming up, and it's raining in on a yellow slick top and bottom, and he comes up to me, and I said, well, look, I'm just meeting somebody. And he says, okay, back the car up a little bit. He's barking orders. He goes around behind. Well, I got him. He does a bumper strip on my rear window, and he comes back around to the side. My hand is there, and he grabs my wrist and gives me a smile, and he says, you've got a great sign on your car. The guy is a member of the fellowship, and he keeps moving on. I almost wet my pants. I really did. I was so thrilled. It just warmed to acknowledge membership in AA. Just a sweet guy. I'll never see him again. I've never seen him before. But for that minute, I was as close to that guy as I've ever been to a human being in my life. The power of the fellowship. All of us know the feeling of driving down the road somewhere on a trip and you see somebody go by and honk the horn in the back and that kind of stuff. It is a powerful fellowship that we're involved in. My personal hero is Clancy I. Clancy England of the LA group. Clancy says, and I totally agree with him, that the work that Bill and Bob did in writing the big book has had, the big book, in other words, of Alcoholics Anonymous, has had the most profoundly positive effect on the lives of more human beings on this globe than any other book written in the 20th century. That, of course, would exclude the Bible and all because it was written earlier. But of all the books and all the medical theories and all the health books and all the wonderful things that man has done for the entire 100 years, in his opinion, the big book of AA has positively affected, in a positive way, more people than any other single book. That is a powerful thing to say and a powerful thing to believe. I've always known it, and I learned it in Fresno. I go back to the beginning just for a short story, and I'll quit. I've been in politics all my life, trying to get people to come to meetings and in schools, trying to, you know, buy them free beer, get them a cookie, anything, just to get a few people to turn out. One of the very first conferences I ever went to was in Fresno, must have been in 1977, I don't remember, but it was my first year. So we came down and we checked into the hotel, which was, used to be the Hilton, which is now, I guess, the W Tree, got a room there the day before the AA meeting, and then they said, well, it's down at the Fresno Convention Center, which is just down the street. Well, I had been at that Fresno Convention Center many times, going to political events, and they would always have searchlights out front, and the police would have the place roped off during the political convention, and, you know, hurting the people and moving them around, and you'd go inside, in the main room, there may be 200 or 300 people at the political conventions, and it was interesting, but it was kind of a hard attempt. So I get over there this time I go to an AA convention over there, and I notice, the thing that I notice mostly, there's nothing. There's no searchlights, there's nothing, nobody's saying anything. There isn't even a parking attendant. The parking lot was just there. You could use it if you want to. There was only one door open. There's about five doors to the convention center, and you can open one. I go inside, and there's a couple of ladies with a card table there. So I paid the $250 or whatever it was, got a name tag, and I'm still running. Where the hell is the convention? There's nothing happening much, you know? Go down a little hall, open the door, go into the room. There's 2,000 people in this room in the convention center. I couldn't believe it. And the guy that was speaking, I've never heard him since, he was an Indian, an American Indian from way up in Canada or somewhere up in Maine. It was the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. One minute I'm laughing, and the next minute I'm almost crying with the pathos and the honesty that's boiling out of this cat. And he's got one of these beautiful Makala-type accents, you know, not the American Indian, but Canadian Indian. That was just fabulous. It was just unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. Back to the hotel. I wanted to call the goddamn L.A. Times or somebody. I just couldn't believe that there'd be that many people would show up at the press, and many, 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 many people cared. The crowning moment, how many of you were able to go down to San Diego to the World Convention down there? I know it was down in San Diego, what, 5 or 6 years ago. I was able to go down there. We went out to the baseball stadium where the San Diego Padres play baseball. Who? What's the name of that stadium? Jack, what's the name of the guy? Huh? Thank you. Jack Murphy Stadium. Were you there?
No.
I go to Jack Murphy Stadium. There are 65,000 people in that stadium. 65,000 people. You know how many people that is? That's a hell of a lot of people. I mean, you know, that's like the city of Oxnard, you know? I mean, that's a tremendous number of people. So all the stands are full. The infield is full. There are people in a beautiful flag ceremony from different nations, and hundreds of nations from all over the world. And then they stood, 65,000 people stood and said the serenity prayer. I mean, it sent chills. I mean, here I am, an old hustler, always trying to get groups to come to meetings and stuff all of my life, bribing them, doing anything. And here is it. And I noticed the demeanor of the crowd and the fact that the policemen who were working the parking lot outside, nobody was pissed. Nobody was honking. Nobody was trying to drive over one another. It was just unbelievable. The love, the language of the heart, the common purpose of 65,000 people in one town. They had to put together a whole new bus system just for the convention. And people in San Diego couldn't goddamn believe it. Nobody said they were coming. Nobody said anything while they were there. And everybody felt wonderful when they left. The bartender suffered. The booze thing didn't go up too much. But, you know, we did all the things that people do. We ate fish and chips. We bought buttons. We laughed. We went to meetings. Smoked a lot. They had to forget about no smoking in the hotels because most AAers still smoke, I guess. But anyway, I'm going to close with that just to say to you that this experience of being at one with my fellows in this fellowship, this place where we deal with the isms, or where we remember that alcohol comes from Bible and alcoholism comes from people. And if you got one, you got them all. You know what I'm saying? I've known people, I was telling somebody at dinner tonight, I saw a guy coming down off a gambling trip. Now, I, as yet, have not experienced my gambling stuff. The reason is, I get so mad that I can't gamble. I go up, I lose $200, I'm going to shoot myself, so I just don't do it anymore. But I saw a guy come down off a gambling trip. Have you ever seen anybody suffering from a run at gambling? It's incredible. So people say to me, you know, well, yeah, but he's a narcotics addict. Bullshit. I say, if you got one ism, you got them all. Now, I believe absolutely that there's no such thing as an old junkie. There's only old drunks. Because when you get too old to carry a TV set, you got to start drinking wine. Right? That's just no other way around. Anything that we can get, those of us that have, anything that we can get that will alter our mind, gambling, chasing, narcotics, booze, and then, of course, there's this phenomena of the ACA, the adult, the second and third generation. Somebody told me the other day there's a new group called the Children of Adult Children of Alcoholics. It's called CASA. I don't believe it. I think they were lying. But the thing about it is, there is a quality of recovery of our 12 steps and our approach that works. It is true that I went to a few meetings and I didn't have the desire to drink anymore. Something that had been running me and compelling me all my early life. I do believe in magic. There is magic in AA. There's one other thing, and I promise I'm going to quit. I did find something here in that crazy work of an inner child, in that all the stuff, and that is God. And I neglect mentioning that enough. But I have found there is a tremendous power, a tremendous ability of the power to come into my life when I am fretting and upset and not doing too well, that comes and calms me like a magic. And my trick is to simply say the serenity prayer. And I'd say, I said it a lot tonight. I was very nervous about coming and talking here tonight. And I would say the serenity prayer. And it does absolutely work. And that is what I call my God. I can be upset and churning and screwing and banging my head around. And remember to say that serenity prayer. Remember to reach out for some humility, and it will come to me. So I can honestly say, in concluding my talk tonight, that I really do thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. But mostly I would like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me my God. Thank you very much.
If you're wondering what I'm doing, I'm praying right now. Talk about wild Indians. I want to thank you for those nice words. Now I wish my wife was here. I met Kathy in AA about 24 years ago. Something to be said about being compulsive, I suppose. But I liked it. My oldest daughter, she's in the program. And Thanksgiving dinner, she came over and telling my wife that she had tickets to see Ken Rogers and Dolly Parton. Because I have a choice, I told my wife she has a choice, either me or Ken Rogers. That's why I'm alone tonight. But I'm the one they call John the Indian. And I like that. I've heard a lot this weekend. I think that among other things that I learned to enjoy in the program is to be able to see myself in other people, to identify and to understand. I enjoyed my friend Jack Friday night, last night. I don't know if you identify the story told about... I think you understood rather than identifying the story told about that 85-year-old man. I don't think you're old enough to identify with that, but not only you understood it, but I think you liked it. I know I did too. I have a friend at home. He's the type of fellow who shares everything. And the other night he was talking about his first sex experience. Said he liked it. He was at home, and he was alone. I don't know if you identify with that. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to look back in your own life and to realize just how grateful you are. Somebody mentioned about time that some of us don't like in AA. But time is reality. And it's God's way of telling us that not everything happens all at once. But time is a beautiful thing because in AA you do learn from your friends. You get some insight about yourself. You get some understanding about the illness of alcoholism. You learn something about prayer. And I have been fortunate enough that I have been given time in AA to learn all these things. And when I look back tonight, I realize that I'm a lucky person. I have a lot to be grateful for. There have been some special people in my life I know that who took time to help me those days when I really needed help and I didn't know how to receive it. One of them was a lawyer. I met him back in 1957. I was in a mission that night because I lived in Skid Row for almost 8 years. I was sober, and a bum came to see me in the mission, and he asked me if I wanted to go to an AA meeting. And I didn't know what an AA meeting was, and I didn't want to go any place because I wasn't dressed, and I needed a haircut. And I have always suffered from wine sores, and that usually took me about 6 weeks before my face would clear up. And when I'm in this condition, I don't want anyone to. You know, they have coffee and donuts, and they're free. So I said, we'll go. I walked into the central group. Central group is meeting like this one. Mixed people from different walks of life. The man who stood at the door that night was a lawyer. And that's what he did every Friday night. He stood at the door and he would shake hands to everyone who came to that meeting. And he would do the same thing after the meeting. He would shake hands to everyone who was leaving. And as I was walking through the doors of AA, he grabbed my hand and he says to me that he was glad to see me. And I wasn't glad to see him at all. Because the only thing I could see was the way I looked, the way I felt. And I sat down, and my first speaker in AA was a lady judge. And I never even knew judge drink. The ones it isn't that I never met one of them before. I met one 43 times, and he never once asked me to try to identify. And she got my mind all screwed up, and all I want to do is get my donut and get the hell out of there. But there was this lawyer. And that's what I'm grateful for. I'm grateful that he understood. Because when you're a bum, and when you have long hair and wine sores, you know, you don't look too well. Not too many.